While you are busy enjoying your lunch, while you are busy having some time from 1300 hours, take time and listen to OTR News Bulletin.
On the radio news analysis, we go beyond the headlines. We don't just tell you what's happening. We ask why it's happening, how it affects ordinary Namibians, and what it means for the country's future. We examine the structures behind news, connect policy to people's lived realities, and bring in expert voices to make sense of where Namibia is heading.
You want to get into touch with global governance, global diplomacy, economic relations, trade, statistics, human and infrastructure development, and you want to see how policy planning and policy implementation is connected in Namibia, make time and listen to OTR from 1300 hours to 1430 with Happy Juju.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Good afternoon, Namibia. You are now listening to On the Reading News Analysis right here on Eagle FM. I am your host, Ndafa Happy Juju. At a time when confidence in institutions, economic stability and public accountability are under closer scrutiny, the need for disciplined thinking and reliable information has never been greater. Now, in moments like this, clarity is definitely not a luxury, but rather a necessity. Now, across the country, from the decision-making offices of Windhoek to the coast fishing economy, the crop fields and the cattle posts of the north and the growing towns of the south, Namibians are engaging in serious reflection, asking questions whether our national budgets are aligned with our development ambitions and whether policy translating into measurable impact, or whether institutions are adapting to meet rising public expectations. Now today we examine some of those and get into understanding of what's making headlines and examining it further. Now On the Radar is not driven by rhetoric. It is guided by evidence, context, and constructive dialogue. Right here, policymakers, analysts, industry voices, and engaged citizens share one responsibility, that is to elevate the national conversation through facts and reasoned debate. As Namibia confronts complex economic decisions and evolving public demands, our commitment remains steady. Thoughtful dialogue strengthens accountability, and in turn, accountability strengthens progress. So stay with us as we analyze the issues shaping our development journey with balance, with depth, and with purpose. So stay tuned. This right here is On the Radar. Now getting right into today's discussions. Government officials and public sector stakeholders are concluding the Namibia Public Sector Innovation Conference that began yesterday and ends today on the 26th of February 2026 at the Windhoek Country Club Resort in Windhoek. Now the Innovation Conference is under the theme Innovating the Public Sector from Policy to Practice. Now the conference was organized by the Office of the Prime Minister with support from other government ministries, including the Ministry of Information and Communication Technology, and was officially opened yesterday by Prime Minister Elia Ngrairi. Now, according to the official program, the event brought together public servants, policymakers and innovation practitioners in order for them to discuss strategies for enhancing public service delivery through innovation, through digital transformation, and through policy implementation. A range of sessions were held over those 2 days, focusing on practical applications of innovation in government systems and services, and for some government agencies, showcased specified projects and solutions that are aimed at improving administrative efficiency as well as responsiveness. The Namibian Correctional Services was, among other entities, also presented an offender management system, which we will take a listen to later on in our conversation, as part of its contribution to improving service delivery. Now, the conference is part of the wider implementation of Namibia's public sector innovation policy, which seeks to promote creativity and better service delivery across government departments. Let's now take a listen to Prime Minister Elia Ngrairi as she spoke at the event at the opening ceremony of this innovation conference yesterday.
Innovation is indeed entering a decisive phase, one that demands faster economic growth, expand employment opportunities, enhance service deliveries both in quality and speed, and greater accountability in the use of public resources. Achieving these priorities require more than incremental reform. It requires rapid transformation in government operations in line with Vision 2030 and NDP 6, which prioritizes economic diversification, youth employment creation, digital transformation, effective governance, and reformed public service. We must recognize a fundamental truth. Economic transformation cannot occur without institutional transformation. A thriving, agile, and resilient economy requires a compatible public service. We are happy, therefore, that we have our friends, the southern neighbor, that are here, who have collaborated with us for a long time, and they are ready to collaborate with us. So please, to our friends that are here, let's give them a round of applause. When entrepreneurs face administrative delays, growth slows. When investors encounter fragmented systems, competitiveness as an investment destination declines. When content creators cannot monetize their efforts, they cannot earn an income. When public servants have to do everything manually, like the Prime Minister is doing, it reduces efficiency. When citizens experience inefficient service delivery, trust erodes. Public innovation is therefore not separate from economic development. It is central to it. The adoption of the policy that Mr. Hansen has spoken and the ED laid the framework for structured and sustainable reform. It recognized that a capable state must continuously adapt, learn, and improve. However, policies do not implement themselves. The responsibility lies with us as leaders, managers, public servants, to ensure that innovation is embedded in everyday practice. Therefore, I am happy that innovation committees in OMAS are functional, according to Mr. Hansen. Innovation champions must be empowered. Institutional performance systems must reward creativity, collaboration, and measurable results. As I understand it, there are 800 committees, members train, 500 champions. Is that correct? Committees, 500. And they are all trained. You are all very competent, ne? Ne? Hands up. Kind of. Very. Give him a round of applause. So therefore, public sector reform requires honesty also. Where we see that we are struggling, let's say so, so that we can identify and diagnose what is it that we need to do better. Is it not? So what you have said just now is not a problem. Nobody is going to hunt you down and say, "Uko menche iso hese." You are part and parcel of the system that corrects itself. If we are able to detect that here we need this, that we need that, we just need to work together. Is it Nisoni? So therefore, esteemed ladies and gentlemen, Namibia, as you know, is a youthful nation. We were, of course, young. The Kanjos, them, all of us, walk young. But that is now taken over by the others. They are here, the young ones. So young people, we know that our demographic profile is both a responsibility and an opportunity. And as always, on youth empowerment in particular, we must walk the talk. We have begun to walk the talk through the Ministry of Finance. This financial year, we have set aside 257 million to the National Youth Development Fund, which we launched in Hobabis, Omaheke region. In the next financial year, it's 500 million. annually, and that is President Netumbo Nandi Ndaitwa walking the talk. Youth empowerment, therefore, must be embedded in policy design, service delivery, and entrepreneurship support and skills development. Innovation in the public sector must create enabling environments for young people to thrive as entrepreneurs, as innovators, as technicians, as professionals, and as public servants, and as content creators. Just the other day, we had a meeting with all MICT stakeholders, and we met some content creators. Some of them have never heard before. You see how we admit, because we are topish now. There was IBEA. What was it called? IBEA. Yeah, you know it. IBEA, yeah, that one. Let's give them a round of applause. We learn about IBEA, we learn about Tala Online, we learn about many, many other things. So the point we are saying in terms of this technological stage of development, no dream of young people, no matter how complicated and sophisticated it sounds, it is their time, it is their era. Let's support them, let's hold them, just as fathers and mothers enabled their children to ride a bicycle. They knew that to balance gravity when you are teaching your child to ride a bike, somehow you will stumble and fall. But to become a perfect cyclist is a process that we go through. So therefore, young people, do not be afraid to stumble and fall sometimes in this trajectory. Your government is going to hold your hand to make sure that your dream become realized. It is in that context, Director of Ceremony, Honorable Minister of MESAC, ED, that technical and vocational education training, TVET institutions, are central to our innovation agenda. A modern economy requires practical skills. A modern public sector requires technical competencies in digital systems, data management, infrastructure maintenance, and service optimization. Strengthening TVET pathways ensures that our youth are equipped not only with theoretical knowledge, but with industry-relevant skills that support industrialization and service transformation. Innovation ecosystem must therefore actively integrate TVET institutions as partners in building Namibia's productive capacity. Honorable Minister of MESAC and ED, you and I were together when the young people of STEAM were talking to us. STEAM stands for science, technology. I'm coming. We learn it today because we were all standing there. This is not something we knew. It's written STEAM, STEAM. Just find out there. They said science, technology, engineering, arts and mathematics. You see, you didn't know, isn't it? It's good to admit, but it is out there. So this is what we mean. They have, they said somewhere near CTM, what? Ivers Darso. That's where they are. So therefore, it is no longer business as usual. We must listen to the pace and the wavelength that young people are moving. As fast as they are moving, they appear to know where they are going. And let us not be so insurmountable in terms of the flexibility of our acceptance of the modernity that is ahead of us. If they say that utopi yekeni didengni, just say yes, yekeni matlier. I think that is what I learned from them when they were talking to us. So Director of ceremonies, equally important is the role of civil society. Innovation is the strongest when it is inclusive. Civil society organizations bring grassroots insights, community engagement, and social accountability. They understand the lived realities of our citizens, especially the vulnerable rural and marginalized communities. A citizen-centered public service must listen, engage, and co-create solutions with civil society sectors. Governance in the 21st century is participatory. It is not that we know better and you don't. We are flexible to listen. One of the most visible expressions, therefore, of innovation is the one-stop service center model of service delivery. For too long, citizens and businesses have navigated fragmented systems that consume time, resources, and opportunity. Therefore, integrated service delivery, whether physical or digital, reduces administrative burdens, accelerates business formalization, improves transparency, and enhances citizen convenience. This model directly supports entrepreneurship, job creation, and inclusive economic participation. It is innovation in service. Innovation must also strengthen our decentralization agenda. That's why we are happy that regional and local authorities are here, and that the regional and local authorities are at the front line of service delivery. The bread and butter issues in any country, including ours, is in the regional and local authorities. They must be equipped with digital tools, skilled personnel, and institutional capacity to innovate locally while aligning with national standards. Ensuring equitable service delivery across regions promotes national cohesion and inclusive growth. However, innovation does not flourish in isolation. It thrives within ecosystem that was earlier mentioned. They enable Namibia to adopt global best practice while designing solutions tailored to our unique context. I told our colleagues, our guests, I reflected during the time when we were young. I know Dr. the CEO of MTC would recall our generation. I lived, my first place where I was renting when I came to Windhoek was Ochomwise, and we were working in town. There was no secret. You must call through a hockey. And in the hockey, you must say, I want to talk to you 3 o'clock tomorrow. So that is the date that you must set the previous day. That ringtone was the same and is heavy. It requires leadership that listens and understands the ingenuity and creativity of the young people. This must result in concrete, implementable action plans aligned to NDP 6 and the public sector innovation policy. The Namibia we seek is clear. A competitive and diversified economy, empowered youth equipped with relevant skills, strong TVET institutions supporting industrialization, active civil society contributing to participatory governance, private sector involvement, transparent institutions, and efficient service delivery systems. Innovation, therefore, is the bridge between our national aspirations and the lived realities of our people. Let this conference mark the beginning of a sustained, inclusive, and measurable transformation. Let us build a public service that not only administers policy, but shapes opportunity. Let us create institutions that are adaptive, ethical, and responsive to the needs of every Namibian. Together, let us move the public sector innovation policy to practice. Together, Let us continue to build a public service worthy of our nation's future. Above all, let us work together and embrace the talent and innovation of our young people, not only in Namibia, but also in Africa and the diaspora. Thank you very much.
And that's the Prime Minister speaking at yesterday's opening of the innovation, that is the Namibia Public Sector Innovation Conference, that is happening over 2 days and is set to conclude today. Now, of course, now let's take a listen to the Correctional, Namibia Correctional Services as they present on offender management system. So let's take a listen to that and try to understand it and come back and actually speak about it. Stay tuned.
The purpose of my presentation is we are going to demonstrate an innovation called offender management system. What is that all about? We will go deep into it. How do we use that innovation to help us collect and manage data and make decisions that are actually based on evidence? So, the outline of the presentation, why do we need an offender management system? What is the rationale behind it? What is the offender management system? What are the legal and policies frameworks that guide us in developing and running the business processes of running a correctional facility? The overview of the offender management system, the benefits that it brought us. There are a few slideshows of demonstrating how the system looks, what we have done so far, and then we move on to the conclusion. Rationale. Currently, Africa is moving and getting committed and embarking on a wave of change when it comes to how we manage our inmates at our correctional facilities. We are no longer all about locking up a person and throwing away the key. We want to rehabilitate them, reintegrate them, so they can become law-abiding citizens and contribute to the economy of the nation. So, and there is a strong professional will for that change. And we all know, and I think many of our foreign colleagues can also attest to the feeling, corrections is the end of the tale when it comes to funding. So whatever resources we have, we need to manage them more effectively and efficiently. So we cannot base our decisions, our judgment on a thumbs up. We need to have a strong data, a strong information that backs those decisions. So the OMS is now becoming, the offender management system is now becoming a backbone for every corrections around the world and in Africa. An offender management system is an electronic data management system where we capture the entire offender population from the time of their arrival to the time of their discharge, the entire incarceration period. And we also capture the offenders that are serving their sentence in community when they are released on parole and remission after going through a whole rehabilitation process. The legal frameworks. We are guided by the tools of the Namibian Correctional Service Act, Act No. 9 of 2012, the Commissioner General's directives and SOPs, and very importantly, the United Nations Standard Minimum Rules of Treatment of Prisoners. For example, Rule No. 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and many others. Rule No. 6 specifically talks about having a standardized data file management system. Rule No. 7 talks about the security. Rule No. 10 and 11 talks about how do you classify inmates? On what basis do you separate them from one another? OMS is a modular design, and it has an audit trail like what my colleague presented. We know exactly what you are doing on the system. So if you make any amendments on the system that are not verifiable, we can go back to the user that amended it, one. Two, we can also retrieve the original form of the record at any time. We have strict role-based access and strict disaster recovery mechanisms in place, because this data is the foundation to our decision-making also. So we need to make sure it's readily available and it's robust enough. In case of any failure, we can switch over to our backups. Benefits. It enhanced the ability to search an inmate. Looking at Namibia as a landscape, it's a very wide country. Imagine if you are not able to tell a family member, no, your son or your daughter or your husband or your wife was transferred from Windhoek Correctional Facility to the Windhoek Correctional Facility. So having that access, or for the courts, where is this particular inmate that was supposed to appear for a court judgment? Where are they? So on a click of a button, all that information is readily available for us. We talk about data. Data on its own does not give you anything. Data, when you apply that data, it turns into knowledge.
Let's pause here now. We'll be back after this scheduled commercial break. Stay tuned.
Why pay more when you can pay less at USAFE stores? Enjoy nutritious and delicious meals for the whole family. 4 kilogram of real good frozen and mixed chicken portions for only 199.99 Namibian dollars. 5 kilos of Polana pasta, just 129.99 Namibian dollars. 500 grams Romy 37% fat spread, just 13.99 Namibian dollars. 700 milliliter crystal gold tomato sauce, just 24.99 Namibian dollars. USAFE, where good food costs less.
The purpose of my presentation is we are going to demonstrate an innovation called offender management correctional facility. So having that access, or for the courts, where is this particular inmate that was supposed to appear for a court judgment? Where are they? So on a click of a button, all that information is readily available for us. We talk about data. Data on its own does not give you anything. Data, when you apply that data, it turns into knowledge. Data, for example, age, is what would you do with an age? I'm 40 years old. But if you combine that 40 years old with the type of offense, for instance, and the nature of the offense and why that offense happened, was the person educated, was the person not educated, helps us get a better understanding and analyzing and solving the critical issue of why, so that this inmate does not re-offend. Eliminates the possibility of data loss. For example, if you are on a file-based system, it's good. Many of the countries have done a spectacular job when managing on a file, but that piece of paper can go missing. But on this, an electronic system with robust disaster recovery, role management, and other security features, we know exactly what is happening on the system. Controlled and restricted access. Let's take an example of health, which is a very sensitive and confidential topic. An officer in charge at a correctional facility does not need to know who is the inmate that is suffering, for example, tuberculosis or HIV. But the medical practitioners needs to know. So that's the separation of duties and roles that we can achieve from managing the information. And it also enables us to share information with our sister organization as a part of a strategic plan. And part of NDP 6, we are already on board and making serious efforts to seek to integrate with all sister departments, judiciary, police, home affairs, and many more. This is the login page. This is, for example, the trend. So far from our offender management system, which went live in 2013 and was built in-house, we have processed more than 55,000 inmates. And as we stand today, our current population is 4,526. We have, each offender has its own profile where you have different modules. Modules, reception and assessment, where we assess the inmate. What are the types of offense? What are their security level? What is the length of their offense? What is their age? Many factors. It's not just the length of sentence that makes you to go to maximum when you are classified. For example, if I commit an offense today in a heat and I go and kill someone, and I have a degree, I had a stable job, I had a stable family, it just happened. Would I go into maximum? Will I even survive there? So that's where having all that information actually helps us to make a right decision, so, and offer right kind of programs that is covered by rehabilitative activities. Then we have the health module, which I think we already understand what it is. We have incidents where we manage all our security incidents. We have transfers, movement of our inmates from one correctional facility to another, and transferring them to international countries, for example, Angola. And then we have multiple reports that we can generate on the system. So this is an example of an average age of an inmate in our correctional facility. Looking at that, we have somebody that is 89 years old. I'm not saying it's there, it's dummy data, but it can give you that kind of information, that what is my highest age. Because when we talk about budgeting, this is a classic example. You would need more money to be spent on that offender that are above a certain age group because of their health issue, because of their mobility. Whereas you will need to know who is your youngest offender, for instance. On that note, basically, this is what one of our innovation, and now we will move on to another innovation from the Namibian Correctional Service, which is the stock and warehouse management system. That would be presented by Senior Superintendent Amushambe. And so I'll hand over the mic to him.
And before the senior actually gets represent the next presentation, which of course we're also going to take a listen to, let's get into why this is quite interesting as the Namibian Correctional Service, of course, alongside other public institutions, presented at the Innovation Conference. Now, they presented on offender management system, and as he spoke there, that the system is designed obviously to take away sort of like the mindset of lock the person up and throw the key away. Of course, there are some people who are behind bars or in jail or in correctional services who, in a heat of a moment, perhaps in a moment of anger, and you and I know that there were instances in our lives where, something just triggered you and made you very angry. And unfortunately, they acted rightly say, irrational way, and took a decision that had, given different circumstances, perhaps with a different mindset and maybe with a calmness that they probably wished that they had at that particular moment in time, they wouldn't have reacted that way. So now they are presenting offender management system, which is part of a broader effort to improve service delivery within Namibia's criminal justice system. And I think I would appreciate this system because he said it tracks from the very beginning of an offender coming in and also until the day they are discharged or they are let go, something like that. I think for lack of better justice words. So now this development is a significant step in towards modernizing correctional administration and of course strengthening public sector efficiency in Namibia. Now an offender management system is digitalized and centralized offender records and replaces the manual and the paper-based processes. I mean, the world is going digital or has gone digital. It's either you catch up or you stay behind. That's just basically it. So this improves accuracy in tracking inmate information such as sentencing details, court appearances, parole eligibility, and rehabilitation progress. And it did say that should anything perhaps be updated or removed, then they'll be able to track the user that actually removed or updated it. I have an understanding that it probably works on a basis where anybody that wants to access it and make any changes, they have to do so by signing in and being able to make changes that would then appear on their name or perhaps on their number that identifies them, perhaps as officer numbers or all I understand from this, I can deduce from that, the person having to update will definitely have to log in into the system and therefore it becomes trackable. You can be able to track that Happy Juju was the one that actually made this amendment. So should anything be incorrect or does not have any reasoning, then you can come back and ask Happy why you made this correction on the 20th of February 2026 without proper guidance or something like that. So that's quite also very interesting in terms of accountability and transparency. So for Namibia, this means that this reduces administrative errors, and thumbs up to that. Because when you're doing it manually, of course, errors are inevitable. But when you're doing it electronically, errors are minimized. And then faster processing of inmate records, and also not just faster processing of inmate records, but also keeping track and being able to access it wheresoever you may be, the person who is making use of it may be. Also, it improves transparency, like I said in the beginning, and also accountability within correctional facilities. It shows that it is an efficient system that will help ensure that sentences are administered correctly or administrated correctly and lawfully as well, which will then strengthen public trust in the justice system. Now, one has to talk about e-justice as well. It sounds quite similar to the e-justice, let's say you have a court date, you can log into your court, into that system using tracking your serial number. Using your case number and then be able to track when you have a hearing, when, what was the last update, you know, in that type of manner. So it's quite efficient. You don't have to call in. You don't have to call to go there to find out when is your next court date. You just check on the e-justice system and it works really, really well. So it then supports rehabilitation and reintegration. Now, modern correctional practice emphasizes rehabilitation rather than punishment alone. Now, as you heard him say, and I repeat it, it opposes locking up someone and throwing away the key. Regardless of the punishment of that person, they still deserve grace. You know, they still deserve an opportunity to life and to better their own life. Yes, this could be a murderer, but then we also need now to focus on this particular person who committed the murder and work on rehabilitation than punishment alone. And of course, if we are to just focus on punishment alone, and I'm sure for those who have probably made case studies on such, they'll be able to tell that when they are finally released and put back in the society, they become worse than they were before. Because, I mean, some of them build up resentment and they build up hatred, and therefore they would want, some of them would want to take revenge. So, and OMS, which is the offender management system, will then allow correctional officers to track each offender's rehabilitation plan, including participation in education, in vocational training, in counseling and behavioral programs. Interesting. Let's say, for instance, now a social worker is going to to see the inmates and talk to them, and they'll not be able to make progress and put up that progress on the system and write that inmate so behavior pattern today was not so good, or it was good and what, and tomorrow or maybe next week when a different social worker comes up and then says inmate was this and this, and then again if the same inmate was the last week comes in the next week and then it shows that the inmate was on their good behavior, you'll also be able to find out deeper things than that, just that which is on the surface, which is then being that perhaps this particular inmate is more comfortable to speak to the first social worker than to other social workers. You know, obviously people tend to align with certain people and certain people tend to make them more comfortable. So that could also help in that angle. And then since we were looking at rehabilitation over punishment alone, we can now conclude, I'm saying we now, as if I work for the Namibian Correctional Service, and then they can now conclude to say, perhaps this particular inmate should align only with this counselor or social worker so as to help them get better. So it's something quite interesting, and I think if they really are going to very indefinitely make use of this or implement this as soon as possible, it's already implemented, then I believe that it will really get somewhere. It will really get us somewhere. I think most of the times when something interesting has been introduced, the problem is not necessarily implementation sometimes. It is making those who are going to be working with it to understand it. And some of the things indefinitely, they are easy to understand, but you still get people that take so long to really grasp it. But then again, you also get people who are not really interested in trying to grasp and understand it. They're not putting in the effort that is necessary. So this structured monitoring will then identify rehabilitation needs early on, and it will measure progress over time, and it will improve preparation for reintegration into the society. Now, by supporting successful reintegration, now maybe I can reduce repeat offending, which is then called recidivism, ultimately contributing to safer communities. It also improves data decision-driven decision making. I think I gave a breakdown of what this is. Reliable data is essential for effective policy making, as the offender management system will then provide real-time statistics on inmate populations, on facility capacity, on demographics and offensive trends. So it better the data will now enable better resource allocation and also infrastructure planning, as well as evidence-based policy reforms. So the offender management system could come in very, very, very handy, most definitely. And also it strengthens interagency coordination, as the criminal justice system involves multiple stakeholders, including courts, including police officers, the prosecutors, and the correctional services themselves. And a digital offender, therefore, a digital offender management platform, therefore, will enhance information sharing between these entities, reducing delays, and of course, cutting down on miscommunication, which will then help timely court appearances, and also improve coordination will also help accurate sentence calculation, as well as efficient parole and release processes. And the integrated approach will then improve overall service delivery across the justice system. And another thing also is that accurate record keeping then protects inmates' legal rights by ensuring that they are not unlawfully detained beyond their sentence terms. And it also supports compliance with national laws and international human rights standards as well. So by investing in such systems, Namibia demonstrates its commitment to lawful, transparent, and humane correctional practices. Now, the presenter, as he was speaking there, he did speak about lack of funding for the sort of to say, when we're talking about funding and perhaps contributions that are being made in the society, contributions for inmates or for offenders, that would be, that is the least on people's mind. That is so true. Because, a lot of people, of course, many of us have this mindset that I would rather spend, I wouldn't even want to spend to give my money to go to those who are offenders or inmates because of, the wicked acts they've done in the society. But if we are talking about integration, it will obviously require money, to require infrastructure. It also require expertise training for correctional officers who then deal with them. And of course, they will need further training beyond, of course, what they already get, and continuous training. We know that when you're especially dealing with people, you need continuous training to also know what is currently working and what is outdated and what is currently recognized. For instance, such as the offender management system. I want to believe that a couple of many years ago, it probably wasn't in existence, and if it was, it wasn't in any way in implementation. But yeah, let's now take a listener to another speaker from the Namibia Correctional Service, who spoke at the Window Country Club for the Namibia Public Sector Innovation Conference, and let's hear what they have to say. They're also from the Namibia Correctional Service.
Thank you.
Yeah. My name is Michael Amushembe. I am from the Directorate of ICT, the Namibian Correctional Service, and I basically build applications for a living. Okay. So the innovation that we are going to speak about today is a stock and warehouse management system that we have built in-house. So basically, we are going to look at the what, the why, and the how we have come to this innovation. So what is a stock and warehouse management system? So it's basically an integrated digital platform designed to oversee the movement and storage of our materials, in this instance, which is our stock, and which will help us bridge the gap between the physical inventory and give us the data oversight that we seek. Because nowadays, data is key, so this is what we need. So what is the problem that we are trying to solve? So our Directorate of Logistics and Administration approached IT and said, we have three key pain points, which is auditing vulnerabilities. We are not able to tell what is where at what point. Number two, the operational blind spots. We are not necessarily able to get the full picture of our stock. Number three, the process inefficiencies. There are so much things that we cannot do for either process reasons or whatever the case may be. So then, as ICT, how can you help us in that instance? So we came on board, we had the talks with them, and then they said, oh, the reasons why we need this basic system is to have operational efficiencies, which will take care of real-time decision-making, reduce wastage or loss. We need a certain level of accountability. We need to know who did what, when, and how, and why that decision was taken. We need audit readiness. So whoever needs to come to us and asks us at the specific point in time and tells, and they would want to say, Namibian Correctional Service, this, we need this specific data today and now. At a click of a button, we'll be able to provide that data. So they also needed some sort of strategic growth, which will be able to give them a platform that is scalable, that can grow on forever. If we get a new correctional facility today or a new stock control point, to be seamlessly integrated. And we also wanted central control of our stock. Hence, we then developed the stock and warehouse management system. So this is a system that will take care of the product's full life cycle, from registration to disposal. Anything in between is catered for, whether it's knowing what stock we have, whether it's knowing where it is or which store it's allocated to, how it's moved, if it's moved to another stock control point, how we use it or whether it's used or not. We also want to know whether it was retained at some point or if something happened to it. We also want to be able to make decisions to say how many of this specific item do we have in stock and when should we exactly replenish our stock at that specific point in time. And then we say with this system, we'll be able to have a precise inventory at our fingertips. We are able to operate agilely, meaning this part is taken care of. Why don't we look at other ways to innovate around our processes? Let's also be audit ready at any time. Let us never be caught off guard, and let us have end-to-end accountability. We know where is what, who did what, when, how, why. That should all be catered for. And this we are all trying to do in transforming the manual and paper-heavy workflows that we have into a highly visibility and data-driven stock management process. So we say the application that we have developed has key features like control point isolation. So if you have different control points, no problem, you are sorted. We want to track the whole life cycle of that specific item the moment it's delivered to us until it exits our stores. We also want to be able to identify and track a specific item individually and know what is happening with it. And as a mean to comply, because we have stock manuals and policies in place, we have started integrating some of the forms like the control cards, the main registers, and the distribution lists and vouchers that we already have in place. And as we continue saying, auditing, auditing, auditing. So in conclusion, we would want to say we have successfully transitioned from a fragmented and paper-based tracking system to a unified digital ecosystem, and which is deployed on multiple control stock points and designed specifically for high security and inventory needs. And we would want to achieve that 100% audit readiness and drastic reduction in operation friction. So our commitment to this task, because we have it developed, is to say this system is built in-house and on the foundation that continues to refine and meet the evolving stock management requirements. With that, I thank you very much for your attention.
Isn't that very interesting? I know I'm getting very excited, but it speaks about being able to be ready for them being ready for audit anytime because of the standard successfully translated from paper-based to now obviously the system that stocks up or stores information on a regular basis and can be updated. Now that is the offender management system as presented by the Namibia Correctional Service, and of course that was done today at the Innovation Conference, or the Namibia Public Sector Innovation Conference. Now of course, that being said, let's pause right here and take a trip to the marketplace. Of course, this is on the reading news analysis. You're also interested, if should you be interested in partaking in the news analysis, you are also invited to partake on 083-288-401. That is 083-288-401. Let's pause here, take a trip to the marketplace. We'll be back shortly. Stay tuned.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I am planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud. So
not a fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
Lipurani angelo wapumbwa Eva tere ulikoni maondo toto ingida ashike kapeno nwe kutete opoye ekukurile. Oshafa fana nongeshefa ili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshiwana. Onongeshefa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi toda njuka okukwetira oipindi konu konda doi inawa. Nune udo.
Care that goes where you go. That's international travel insurance through NHP. We facilitate cover of up to 10 million Namibian dollars per member for medical emergencies abroad as part of your membership. No extra charge. To receive your policy within minutes, simply register at nhp.com.na before you travel. T's and C's apply. NHP, rooted in care for you.
Your health, your life, your peace of mind. NHP, we're about you.
Kukwetira oipindi konu konda doi nawa. Nune udo o tukwetira o special.
Welcome back, and now brace yourself for 4 economic indicators and thereafter news beyond the borders of Namibia. We're starting off with the Namibian dollar in comparison to the US dollar. So 1 USD is equals to 15.83 Namibian dollars. So definitely the Namibian dollar is strengthened itself against the US dollar. And this has been going on for months. Now the one Australian dollar is equals to 11 Namibian dollars and 26 cents. United Arab Emirates dirham is equals to 4 Namibian dollars and 43 cents, and £1 sterling is equals to 21 Namibian dollars and 42 cents. 1 euro is equals to 18 Namibian dollars a point 72 cents, and 1 Swiss franc is equals to 20 Namibian dollars a point 41 cents. 1 Botswana pula is equals to 1 Namibian dollar and 21 cents, and 1 Kenyan shilling is equals to 0.12 Namibian dollars. And now we head over to news beyond the borders of Namibia. But before that, let's pause here and we'll be back shortly. Stay tuned.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud. So
not a fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcome back, and now moving on, this beginning off in South Africa concerning the budget speech competition by Minister of Finance, that is Enoch Godogwana.
We will be able to prove that we can arrest people for money laundering or any of these things, prosecute them. You've got nice laws. We don't deny that. But do you prosecute people? Do you do that? That's effectiveness. So we should not be relaxing. We should be working hard. So again, I'm raising that is one of the key issues which is featuring prominently in the budget, the issue of peace and security. Growth, peace and security. Of course, without ensuring that the socio-economic rights of our society are achieved, you are not going to have peace and stability. A key component of that is how do we, in line with what the Constitution enjoins us, achieve socio-economic, realization of socio-economic rights. That's what we want to achieve. Coming back to fiscal prudence and deal with the questions from the postgrads. During the medium-term budget policy statement last year, we announced a movement to a lower inflation target of 3%, which brings credibility to monetary policy because you are anchoring inflation expectations. This now policy clarity in relation to monetary policy. We're coming to a controversial point of saying, how do we bring that clarity and credibility on the fiscal side? How do we bring that clarity and on the fiscal side? It's a controversial issue because politicians are going to pose the question and say, you have removed us from making decisions that are critical on monetary policy. You have outsourced that to the Reserve Bank. Now you want us to outsource fiscal policy by saying, now we must be not have authority on how we deal with fiscal policy by tying us to regulations and so on. What the manner in which we are trying to construct it is not something that says you will, as for instance other jurisdictions say, you will not exceed, for instance in the euro zone where you had the Maastricht rule which says you won't exceed a 3% or that or that. No. We want to have a discussion with Parliament and Cabinet that says we must have a rule, whatever that rule, which says if a government of the day in 5 years, in 2029, we have got an election, a new government comes in place, whatever its composition. I've learned a lot with the coalitions last year, so I can give a lecture or two. That government administration must be able to say to Parliament, what is going to be our fiscal strategy? And be accountable to Parliament for that fiscal strategy over its five-year term. Does that mean you can avoid a new figure? No.
In other news in South Africa, South African small businesses have turned to solar power in order to overcome outages.
South Africa's recent issues with power generation are well documented, with the state-owned utility resorting to restrictive policies, including load shedding, to ensure the grid didn't suffer bigger problems. Recent reforms have helped stabilize the system, but many businesses have already decided to take the matters into their own hands. In recent years, solar power has become an affordable and practical alternative. And there's only one country largely responsible for that.
China's role is extremely important. If I were just to give you a little bit of background in terms of how China got to this point, it was not incidental. China, from the 50s already, had been working on solar PV technology, and they were looking at industrializing it, commercializing it, and making it widespread. They pumped a lot of money in terms of research and development. And this is why what we're seeing today, where 8 out of 10 panels are manufactured in China, is by design. And so as a result, then China then exports these panels all over the world.
Currently, South Africa remains the largest importer of Chinese solar panels in Africa, accounting for roughly one-third of all Chinese shipments to the continent.
In 2025 alone, more than 6 million solar panels were imported into South Africa from China.
This is according to energy think tank Ember's data. For centuries, reliable power generation has been responsible for the making and breaking of economies across the world. Those that could do it well thrived. Those that couldn't tended to disintegrate. And experts say today is no different.
The main factor is that Africa really does need more electricity generation. It's got a rapidly expanding population. Electricity supply is, even in the cities, is often not nearly what it should be. So we complain about outages in this country, but in other countries it can be much worse. So improving electricity supply will not only just ease sort of everyday experience of people living there, but it will also mean that the economy, which relies on the regular electricity supply, would be able to perform much better. China's shown what is actually possible as far as expanding your solar power generating capacity. They've done things which have been astounding other countries in the world, shown what the scale at which you can do it.
Many South Africans are now benefiting from the boom in solar, especially small businesses.
I teach people how to make music online. So a lot of my time I spend here, I'm online teaching people how to make music. And then for that to happen, I need electricity. I need to have the internet. So each and every time I have power cuts, so it affects my business because I'm not able to use the internet due to when the electricity is down, then my Wi-Fi is also not working. So I always need Wi-Fi to be able to stream online. So yeah, it affects me a lot. So I chose to move from where I was staying to a place where there are solar panels. So I know there's a backup each and every time the electricity is not available. So it helps me a lot because there's never a day where I can say I'm not able to do my business just because I don't have electricity.
China is also significantly boosting South Africa's renewable energy transition by investing $35 million in a new solar panel assembly plant in Mpumalanga province. Yuli Sanjamala for CGTN in Johannesburg, South Africa.
Moving on, we're heading over now to Zambia as SMEs in Zambia are tipped to tap school feeding.
The Ministry of Small and Medium Enterprises Development has held a meeting with small businesses operating in various industry yards. The meeting aimed at ensuring that the yards become centers of production, innovation, and sustainable employment, helping transform small businesses into stable and competitive enterprises. Acting Small and Medium Enterprises Development Minister Chipoka Mlenga says the equipment installed in the yards must be fully utilized to enable businesses begin generating revenue.
Yes, others are trying to do it. Maybe it is the ability or the know-how that we do not have. We invest, but our business crumbles. There is no shame in raising your hand and say, I need capacity building. I can farm properly, but I don't know how to manage the business that you have given me. Can there be capacity building in access to finance or financial literacy, in business support? The Africa Development Bank, whom we've partnered with, can bring the right people to support us.
And the ministry's permanent secretary, Suveta Mutelo, explained the aim of the meeting.
This meeting, therefore, serves several important purposes. One, to explain the transition arrangement following the end of the project. Two, to clarify the new management and oversight framework. Three, to engage tenants on operational challenges affecting the yards.
Meanwhile, the Kafue Industrial Yard chairperson, Jacob Chunga, says the yards have played an important role in enhancing small businesses in the country.
I want to say this. We are grateful for these opportunities. A lot of Zambians out there are asking about these industrial yards, and they would love to be part of them. Then our security position. When we started with Zambia National Service, we had a few issues here and there. But I got to tell the truth. I think they have done a fantastic job so far, and they're keeping our premises very safe. We can sleep at night.
These industrial yards will help stimulate growth, create sustainable jobs, promote industrialization and economic resilience in Zambia. Onesta Mshoka, ZMBC News, Lusaka.
Meanwhile, Zimbabwe has rejected $350 million health deal with the U.S.
A letter dated December 23, 2025 and directed to the Ministries of Health and Finance, Zimbabwe's Foreign Affairs Secretary, Mr. Albert Chimbindi, said the President had ordered the discontinuation of talks on a memorandum of understanding that he said blatantly compromises and undermines the sovereignty and independence of Zimbabwe. The U.S. was seeking direct access to Zimbabwe's health data and separately access to critical mineral resources under the proposed framework. Harare also objected to entering a bilateral health pact after Washington had withdrawn from the World Health Organization. Zimbabwe's health sector is underfunded and heavily reliant on donor funding for critical equipment and drugs, as well as to pay its health workers. Stakeholders in the health sector have urged government to cut back on unnecessary expenditure and direct more resources to the sector, especially in the face of diminishing donor funding. Farai Makutuya, CGTN, Harare, Zimbabwe.
Meanwhile, Kinshasa's population boom drives unregulated sand mining.
Much of Kinshasa's city's growth is informal, sprawling out to the savannah south and east of the capital. These problems stem from rapid and planned urbanization. Without sufficient planning, the capital is expanding into areas that lack basic infrastructure and services like drainage systems and solid waste management.
The biggest problem we have is that the sewage systems that were originally built according to the city's master plan have been completely blocked by buildings. The current authorities have neither taken the city plan into account nor revised it to adapt to the population growth.
What's more, green spaces are being replaced by concrete, metal, and bare earth, ushering in climate challenges like flooding, soil erosion, and higher temperatures.
La meilleure solution, c'est...
Authorities must sit down with urban planners to find a solution, which in my view is to practically review and redesign all the city's drainage systems.
This is where it all begins, eking out a living along Kinshasa's Njili River. Arnold Mangani dives to the bottom of the waterway several times a day to get sand, which his superiors sell to construction companies. He operates without any safety gear, and that has come with its challenges.
The water in this river is a world of its own. We experience many problems working here. We sometimes contract diseases like malaria, rheumatism, and other illnesses that cause our legs to shake. But we must continue working because we have no other job opportunities.
More than 500 men work at this site on the outskirts of Kinshasa.
Sand mining has become a booming business here because of the rapid growth of the construction industry. Hundreds of young men like those behind me support their families from this trade, but it's not well regulated.
Sand is a key ingredient for making concrete and other materials used in buildings that are changing Kinshasa's skyline. The widespread unemployment in the city has attracted many young men to this industry, but their leaders say competition from foreign firms is pushing them out.
The number of mining sites has hugely increased in this city. Foreign investors are really making it difficult for us to make a profit. When we sell the sand at, say, 65,000 Congolese francs, the investors sell theirs at 60,000. They have large machines and modern equipment that we can't match. I don't know where we'll end up.
For now, dozens of trucks continue arriving here to get sand from these men. But experts warn that extracting sand in large quantities has a negative impact on the environment.
So when you mine sands, there is a ionizing element which is called radon. Is in the form of gas. It can come out from the sand. It can come anywhere from the atmosphere. But it has to be regulated. We have to know exactly what is coming down under the ground and what if that element is in the sand they are mining. And the good news is like, the minister of
where people want
scientific scientific research science had a decree I think 6 months ago trying to see if the ionizing element can be controlled in the atmosphere, and they gave that decree to us, which is we start controlling radon in sands, in constructions around Kinshasa and everywhere also.
Regulating the industry may affect the livelihoods of Arnold Mangani and his colleagues, for whom this sand is not just grains, but a means to their survival. And so, despite the risks, they keep collecting sand, one boatload at a time, to provide for their families. Chris Ochamringa, CGTN, Kinshasa, Democratic Republic of Congo.
Well, let's delve further into that. And joining us from Kinshasa now via Zoom is Detty Numbi. She's an architect and urban planner. Great to have you with us on the show, Detty. Now, of course, the first question that comes to mind is regulation. What does regulation look like in the sector? Is there any regulation at all? And if there was going to be regulation, what would it look like?
Hello. There are regulations in the DRC about that. The only thing is that we have a problem with the reinforcement of the law. Most of our laws here, according to what we see in the cities, we don't respect the law. And for the advice I can give as a planner or as an architect is the government has to do fair and transparent pricing about that issue, because most of those young people, they are not employed. So they are looking for something to do to get some money. So the issue here, there are many aspects. We have issues in the social aspect, the economical aspect, and the environmental aspect. So we can't only see that there is danger, environmental danger with the river, people going inside for that. We have the government has to see the three aspects of the in terms of the sustainable development. So we need to do a no harm regulation packages, and it will need a lot of things and time to do that, and to change as well the mindset of the people.
And I'd like to get a sense of what you think. Do you think there can be regulation that sort of balances out protecting the environment, at the same time doesn't hurt employment for this young people, and also keeps sand prices properly priced in the market?
Yes, it's possible to have, to respect and to have those regulations. The thing is, we need to involve engineers, people that knows how geologists and people in the domain, the field, to know how to do exactly. Because in Kinshasa, we have a problem with the with urbanization. Most of the people coming from other provinces, they think that here in Kinshasa is the paradise. So we need to plan and manage all those this stuff going issues going with the urbanization. So I think if we have to how can I say it, to manage that issue as well, it will be a good thing if the politician or the government can work together with the people in the science, in the engineer, in the science of environmental science.
Mm. And I don't know, is there a sense of the demand for sand in Kinshasa right now, and whether these informal structures are helping to meet that demand?
The demand, unfortunately, the demand is very big, because Kinshasa has a lot of people. We are almost 20 million people in this town. And the construction is not going with the regulations. So the demand goes informally.
Now for some international news, President Donald Trump has delivered the 2026 State of the Union Address.
The President of the United States!
With his approval poll numbers tanking, Trump delivered the longest State of the Union in history, beating his own record set last year for a drawn-out speech focused largely on what Republicans view as a record of progress since he took office just over a year ago.
When I last spoke in this chamber 12 months ago, I had just inherited a nation in crisis with a stagnant economy, inflation at record levels, a wide open border, horrendous recruitment for military and police, rampant crime at home, and wars and chaos all over the world. But tonight, after just 1 year, I can say with dignity and pride that we have achieved a transformation like no one has ever seen before, and a turnaround for the ages. It is indeed a turnaround for the ages.
A portrayal that collides with the views of most Americans who remain anxious about an affordability crisis. Just days after the Supreme Court dealt a seismic blow to the president's economic agenda that many argue is partly responsible for Americans being hit in the pocket.
An unfortunate ruling from the United States Supreme Court. It just came down. It came down. Very unfortunate ruling. But the good news is that almost all countries and corporations want to keep the deal that they already made, right, Scott? Knowing that the legal power that I, as president, have to make a new deal could be far worse for them, and therefore they will continue to work along the same successful path that we had negotiated before the Supreme Court's unfortunate involvement.
Sitting that will be remembered for its heckling. Trump asked lawmakers to stand if they agreed that the first duty of the American government was to protect American citizens and not undocumented immigrants, leading to this exchange after Democrats remained in their seats.
Ashamed of yourself not standing up. You should be ashamed of yourself. Ashamed of yourself.
Representative Ilhan Omar shouting back, "You're the murderer, you should be ashamed," after two Americans were killed in January while protesting immigration tactics in Minnesota, while Representative Al Green was ejected from the chamber after holding up a sign that read, "Black people aren't apes." Trump also boasted about the military's illegal takedown of Venezuela's ousted president, Nicolas Maduro, calling that country a new friend and partner. He pointed to his efforts to bring peace to conflicts around the world, including in Gaza, and then on Iran. This. amid growing concern of an imminent military escalation.
Deal, but we haven't heard those secret words. We will never have a nuclear weapon. My preference is to solve this problem through diplomacy. But one thing is certain, I will never allow the world's number one sponsor of terror, which they are by far, to have a nuclear weapon. Can't let that happen.
Meanwhile, U.S. and Iran tensions. Nuclear talks are set to take place in Geneva on Thursday.
Let's go now to Washington, where Patty Culhane is standing by. So, Patty, Marco Rubio says it is a big problem that Iran won't talk about its ballistic missiles. And I just wonder what kind of expectations that Rubio is setting for the talks.
You know, it's very, very different than what we're hearing from U.S. President Donald Trump. He has repeatedly mentioned that he's considering a military strike, another military strike on Iran. Talking to reporters, he said we'll know more in 10 days. Then he said something about 2 weeks. But we're talking to reporters in the Caribbean. The U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said, look, this should be characterized as just the next chance to sit down and talk. And when it comes to the ballistic missile program, he did say that they're going to talk about the ballistic missiles eventually, he hopes, but they're going to focus on nuclear first, saying if you can't get through nuclear, then there's no point in trying to get an agreement on ballistic missiles. Now, I think a lot of people in this country and around the world have been waiting for the Trump administration to explain why now, why they see Iran as an imminent threat. I think a lot of people expected the president would do that during the State of the Union. He did not devote very much time to it. He just simply said that Iran was told not to try and reestablish its nuclear program. They talked about these missiles that could be a potential threat to U.S. forces in the region. But it was interesting, in listening to Marco Rubio's comments to reporters, he admitted that Iran is not currently enriching uranium, but he said they are trying to get to the point where they can. So as far as describing why they see Iran as an imminent threat, the Trump administration still, quite simply, just hasn't.
Yeah, and they're still keeping up this maximum pressure campaign, Patty. They've just imposed new sanctions on Iran. I wonder if you could tell us what they are and what impact they're likely to have on these talks.
Well, we saw the Treasury move on the eve of these talks to sanction individuals, about 30 people, 12 ships and some other companies that they say are part of the Iran's drone industry and also is selling of Iranian oil. So what is the impact of that? Well, if you are an Iranian businessman who's decided to keep your money in U.S. banks in the United States, then they could potentially freeze that. Now, it seems highly unlikely that any Iranians have actually decided to put their assets in the United States. It does bar Americans from doing business with these companies, these individuals that have been sanctioned. That's pretty much already prohibited with a bunch of different regulations. So really, it's more symbolic, sending a message of pressure to the Iranian delegation on the eve of these talks, because it's been reported that President Trump is very miffed by the fact that he has not gotten Iran to capitulate. So sending the message with economic sanctions and with talk of military.
And with that, we have come to the conclusion after this episode of On the Reader News Analysis. Do stay tuned for the Onkanana Dengue program, brought to you by Louise Shimi. From Indafa, happy Juju, it is goodbye. I'll see you again tomorrow, same time, same place, same radio app, same frequency, and of course, same website. And from 1300 hours to 1430. Goodbye.